This is DGMT's Learning Lunch, and I'm your host, Rahima Esop. Today we are going to talk about social connections in all its forms, from harnessing the power of social capital, that's the value of our relationships and who we interact with, to the power of collective connectedness to spark wide-scale positive change. A growing body of research tells us that people's social connections predict mobility. For instance, Harvard researchers in the United States have mapped the childhood roots of upward social mobility, demonstrating how neighborhood factors, that's where people grow up, their geography, shape their outcomes. Pathways to social mobility are weak in fractured communities or communities that have low access to resources or no access to resources, as well as high levels of poverty. These patterns are pronounced in South Africa, where the poorest among us are socially and economically disconnected from the rest, setting them up for lifelong underachievement and exclusion. To talk about this, I'm joined by Rajan Woodroff from the Bulungula Incubator, Adam Cooper from the Human Sciences Research Council, and Lihle Mbekwana, Program Manager for the Vibrant Village Initiative. Three people who have been researching, thinking about, and engaging with the work of promoting social connections for the benefit of young people and creating economic opportunities for them. From one of our country's most remote areas to the economic hub of Johannesburg, they bring a wealth of ideas and insight on this issue. You would be forgiven if you've never heard of Bulungula. It's a remote part of the Eastern Cape. What it lacks in modern comforts, it makes up for in pristine natural beauty. Development has been slow, and the legacy of apartheid has limited social mobility. But in 2004, my first guest, Rajan Woodroff, worked with the community of Bulungula to open a lodge, with the idea that they could leverage tourism as a tool for rural development, if they invested the profits back into the communities. Rajan, tell me what led you to the Bulungula area. How did you end up there?
During the 80s, I grew up in Cape Town. I was very much involved in the anti-apartheid struggle. I was chairperson of the SRC at our high school, and being involved in community organization was something that had deeply affected me and influenced me during that time. After school and university, we all thought, student activists thought, well, our job here is done. We got democracy. We voted in 1994, and there was nothing more to do. But I started working in the finance industry, and after 10 years or so, I realized actually our work wasn't over. There was an enormous amount that needed to be done in order for us to build the country into the kind of society that we want to live in. And I was drawn back into development work and into community organization. And the stars aligned, and I met the person who was to become my life partner, David Martin. He had started building the Bulungula Lodge, and I met him in the year that he started building it. So the Bulungula Lodge opened in 2004. It was a partnership with the local community, and it was doing incredibly well as a black-owned business. But there were other problems that we wanted to address, problems of very high child mortality, lack of access to quality education and healthcare, and we needed an NGO structure to do that, because the Bulungula Lodge, even though it's community owned, was a business entity, and we launched the Bulungula Incubator as an NGO to start to look at issues around education, healthcare, youth acceleration, sustainable livelihoods. And so that's the short version of the story.
How did that benefit those residents?
I think it's just about exposure to what is possible, which is why the Bulungula Incubator wants to be a catalyst. We just want to open up those connections, and then they lead into so many different avenues that we couldn't even have anticipated, and that then just, you know, grows from there and creates a virtuous cycle.
Can you give some examples of what those avenues are?
We had a principal of a private school who just came as a guest to the Bulungula Lodge, and he met one young person who was just selling traditional made clothes at the lodge to tourists. And he had spoken to and engaged with, and she hadn't finished her schooling. And he said, well, I will find a scholarship for you. I'll find a place for you to stay in Cape Town. And she was able to do that, to come to Cape Town to study high school. And then another person from the community then got connected into that school and then got a scholarship. So that's one example of that happening. And then people coming and saying, I know how to do soap making. You know, you can grow lemongrass, which just grows very easily in that climate. And they were growing lemongrass. And then somebody said, well, you know, if you just turn this into an essential oil, you can make soap from it. And to this day, they're still making soap and selling those soaps. So that's another idea that I might not have even thought of in Cape Town, you know, but it just happened to be that people coming with these ideas. We had a masseuse come and who taught massage, and now there's massage at the Burungula Lodge. So there are many different examples of where it's just about ideas, you know, the flow of ideas. When you are disconnected both physically because the infrastructure is bad, the road infrastructure, the internet infrastructure, the electricity infrastructure, how do you just know what's out there? And so it's just people and flow of ideas that has been really beneficial, and that's you know, helped to spark ideas and new opportunities.
Absolutely. And the benefit for young people, you spoke about the scholarships. I think that's a nice segue to bring in Lihle. Lihle, you almost dropped out of school at one point, but you persevered with the support from the adults in your life, and now you are doing your part to uplift your community. Tell me about your journey.
I started schooling back at home in the village. We will have one class a week. At the age of 15, it was 2011, my mother decided to take me out of the village and send me to Free State, where my grandfather was working. I was far behind. I was like a grade 3 learner in grade 8. And then I couldn't read and write. I don't mention speaking English in the edition of Afrikaans that I should do in that class. I nearly drop out because I feel embarrassed when there is a presentation. I don't know how where will I start. But then I managed to get to grade 12. After I graduated to grade 12, I noticed that, you know what? I'm the first person in the house, in the home, to get matric. So there is no one who will help me to get to tertiary institution. I took a decision of leaving Free State and getting back home. I tried to see which route should I take to make my future bright. Lucky enough, then comes a new opportunity of becoming an online learning facilitator, which is named eTablet Chomis. This year, I'm just being appointed to become a Vibrant Village manager.
What is Vibrant Village and how is it contributing to the overall well-being of the community there?
A Vibrant Village is one of the Bulungla Incubator's element trying to achieve a common goal, which is economic development, in such a way that we groom youth to become positive thinkers, to become creative. Active, we grow the vibrancy inside of them, the heart of willingness. Like, I want to be there. I want to get matric. I don't want to drop out of school.
Tell me about the job opportunities now available in your village for young people as a direct consequence of the economic development with the lodge and with the incubator and the other initiatives that Rajan and her partner have started.
You can be a radio presenter, which now we are staying at 12 radio presenters who are getting subsidy from the BI. You can now work at the lodge. There are so plenty of opportunities. You can become an ECD teacher. You can become the Nomakaya, which is our home care-based workers. So there are so many opportunities that are created by one organization now.
And I just want to throw back to you, Rajan, because in 2004, things looked very different. There are tablets now, whereas before there was no connectivity. I believe that people were writing letters to communicate with one another. Just paint us a picture of what things looked like back in 2004.
Imagine the hills of the former Transkei region, the hilly area where Nelson Mandela was born and where he grew up. And you have your rondavels with your thatch roof, houses that people build themselves with mud brick, and they harvest the grass themselves. And it's an incredibly beautiful place, the most beautiful beaches. I mean, the Wild Coast is 300 kilometers of the most beautiful beaches in the country with indigenous forests. From our village, you would walk, I'm a physically fit person, and it would take me Well, first 1 hour walking over the hills to get to the river. Then you've got to cross a rickety little boat, which is the local ferry. And at the time, you would pay 2 rand to cross on the ferry, get to the other side of the river, walk over more rolling hills for another hour, and then get to the clinic. That's if you're in a physically fit condition. Imagine if you're pregnant, or you're an elderly person, or you're somebody trying to get your 3-year-old, your 5-year-old, and your 7-year-old to get the immunizations at the clinic. It's virtually impossible. So access to healthcare was very hard. There was no clean drinking water. We did a survey, the Wollongong Incubator did a survey, and we found that half of the households had lost at least one child to diarrhea. 1 in 9 had lost 3 or more. I know a family that lost 8 children to diarrhea from lack of access to clean drinking water. And there was no access to functional schooling. The local government school was a mud structure that had collapsed. So all the services that you need in order to live a flourishing human life, you didn't have access to. Poverty is not a lack of money or resources. Poverty is a lack of information and knowledge about what your rights are and knowing what access there is to the information you need that can change your situation. You know, so just having information is incredibly powerful. And that's how you are can be in a situation of poverty and not get out of it, is not having information, networks, and being connected to other human beings that can help you out of a situation.
Adam, I want to bring you in now. We've heard how social connections in the rural Eastern Cape have led to economic connectedness and job opportunities for people who live in that area. But you don't have to be in an isolated or remote part of the country to be socially and economically disconnected. You found situations where even in an area like Gauteng or Johannesburg, to hone in more closely, there is disconnectedness socially and economic disconnectedness. Tell me about what you found.
Thanks, Rahima. I think in South Africa, our cities were designed to be disconnected. Apartheid was about separateness. And so I think that they've been intentionally designed to keep the poorest people away from the best opportunities, the best sets of social relations. And our cities have been designed to do that. My research project that tried to look at how young township people create opportunities through the resources they have access to in very creative ways, in very innovative ways, showed me how difficult it is sometimes to transcend those divisions. And the young people that I was interviewing were using those divisions to their advantage. They were using their own environments, the stories as they spoke about them. They would often say, we offer raw or authentic experiences to tourists. Township tourism is quite a contentious topic, but I think in the ways they were trying to do it, it was to say, I'm a storyteller, I'm going to tell you a story about where I live and to bring you into my space in ways that are really innovative. I think they were using resources that they'd acquired often outside of the township, things like English language skills, access to other institutions in ways that were empowering. But it was about trying to bridge those divisions that many of the young people I interviewed in Gauteng, and I say many, but it was really very few, in trying to do a research project that looked at how young people were creating job opportunities for themselves in ways that weren't disempowering or demeaning, or many of the young people spoke about being in a supermarket packers or picking apples and experiencing blatant racism and rejecting low-wage work because they found it unpleasant, creating opportunities for themselves that used the resources they had. And it was only a very small, select group in asking people, do you know others who are making a living through the tourism industry in this way, in a city like Johannesburg, which is probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 million people. I kind of accessed a group of maybe 10 young people that were successfully creating work for themselves in this way. But it's a very small number in a very large city. And so I think it shows you how difficult it is to create those connections in a city like Johannesburg.
How does education play a role?
Talking about this group of young men, they were mainly young men that I interviewed, I think there were huge differences between the one young man who won a scholarship to attend a very prestigious private school in Johannesburg, those that managed to attend former Model C schools, and those that were educated at township schools. And I think that the kinds of networks, for example, that exist at a private school like St. John's in Johannesburg just blow your mind in terms of how that kind of space gives access to a range of resources and opportunities that someone at a township school just really battles to get the same level of access to. I think former Model C schools, many of them with predominantly still white teachers with their own social circles, networks, certainly gives people opportunities that someone who's kind of ensnared in a township scenario really struggles to access. So I think it is about physical geography. I think we can break these boundaries down, but I think that the way social networks work is also quite complicated, and it's really about thinking about our institutions and who has access to them, who doesn't, and also transforming those that really would offer certain kinds of opportunities. I think it's also about access to capital, people who want to start a business. It's about access to markets, which is often based on who you know. And to just give you an example of one of the young men, the one that did attend St. John's, he took 900,000 people so far, him and his company, up a dilapidated building in central Johannesburg. It's the fifth most popular tourist attraction on TripAdvisor. And that was through certain relationships he built at a private school that's enabled him to spread that business in a way that the young man who started a bicycle tour of his neighborhood wasn't able to do. Access to capital, access to networks on social media, and that 900,000 people is without spending more than 100 rand on advertising. So the word of mouth spread that you get through international networks, through national networks, is just very different to a young man who starts a bicycle tour by borrowing a few hundred rand through his mother's pension to buy a few bicycles and to try and attract tourists in that way.
So for the benefit of our listeners, St. John's is a private school in Johannesburg. And it just goes to show that beyond just quality education, what benefited this young man are the contacts that he made at that particular school and their contacts in terms of their families and their extended social connections. Rajan, I want to bring you back into the conversation. From what you've learned with the Lodge and Bulungula Incubator, for the benefit of our listeners today, share three or four things that you've learned about how to promote social connections in a way that would promote economic connectedness. What are the magic ingredients?
The obvious one is, and that's the easy one, is you need infrastructure. Because without having road access or having access to the internet or electricity to charge your phone, you aren't going to be connected, right? So there's the physical infrastructure that's needed, and that would be for, you know, whether it was government or corporates or foundations or whatever, to think about how do you physically put access to the internet, number one, and that's starting to come, right? Those kind of infrastructure is starting to come. But then once you have that in place, that doesn't work just on its own. So, for example, at the Bulungula College, we opened a tech center that had laptops and tablets and free access to Wi-Fi and internet. And we thought we're just going to open this thing and it would, with free internet, you're just going to have young people filling up the place and we won't be able to cope. And for the first months of that tech center being opened, can you believe it? There was nobody there, right? None of the students came and used it. And then we realized it's because how would you know what the internet could do? I mean, you don't have a smartphone. You've never used the internet. When you did your computer training, and this is the problem when you start computer training is, I mean, it is necessary to learn how to use a mouse and how to make, you know, highlight something, but it's boring, you know? So the kind of computer, traditional computer training was, you know, highlight a sentence and turn it into bold font. And so everybody was yawning and falling asleep and they weren't coming to the tech center at all. So one of our program managers said, okay, I'm going to solve this problem, and stood in front of the class and said, how many ants are there in the world? And so all the kids looking at him like, what are you talking about? Who knows how many ants there are in the world? Now, when you type in how many ants there are in the world into Google, Google will give you an answer. There is a number. Then it was, who's the best soccer player in the world? The shortest person and the tallest person. And then you see those photographs with a very short person and a very tall person. And it just lit a spark. It's not just about putting in place the infrastructure, it's what can that infrastructure do for you? And that's really, that would be my point number two, is how do you use that? And then point number three, role models. I know that people say this often, but it is the most powerful thing that influences young people, are role models that they can relate to. In fact, our Tablet Chomies program, which Lihle mentioned, it's our e-learning program in the government primary schools that the Bulungula Incubator does from grade 1 to grade 12. Our facilitators, who are unemployed people from that rural community, have got a statistically significant impact on the learning experience of those learners, because they say to the learners, I've done the maths program and I can do it. And if I can do it, you can do it. And that is having an incredible impact on how learners are progressing. And so the power of that is priceless. And so that is to do with role models, particularly around mathematics. But our radio DJs all come from the local community, you know? I mean, the power of that voice on Bulungula Radio is something, I mean, I can't even describe the value of that. And so I would say I would make that one of my essential points too.
Adam, same question to you. What, in your experience, are some of the ingredients or factors that would promote social connectedness?
So I think we can really use recreation better than we do in this country. In thinking about the young man that I described who runs a tour going up a dilapidated building, that project started with him taking some of his friends from his private school back to his community on the weekend where he lived, turning their iPhones off so their parents couldn't track them down, and going out and having fun in a place that was, in their minds, a bit dangerous, exciting, different, learning about other spaces. And I think using that idea that recreation doesn't necessarily have to be drinks at a fancy hotel in central Cape Town, it can be learning about the communities that we all live in and exposing people to different spaces. I think one of the challenges with that, in talking to a friend last night whose child is at a very good Cape Town school and trying to organize a trip to an old age home in Grassy Park, half of the class's parents won't allow the kids to go to Grassy Park, which I see as a totally middle class suburb. But the fear of going beyond some of these apartheid divisions is still very real for people. So how do we create recreational opportunities where people can go and enjoy life in other spaces? So that would be the first thing. As I've mentioned before, that the schooling system is still one of the biggest dividers in a big city like Cape Town, and who is able to access which schools. From a year or two ago, they have reassessed admissions policies and who is able to take control of that process. And I think that there are developments being made to allow it to become more democratic and break down some of these previous divisions in our city. But I think really looking at institutions like schools and making connections between schools as well. There can be buddy systems where schools work with each other to share resources and enable children to meet each other as a second point. I think the third point, and I don't know how to turn this into what can you do on your own at home, but simple skills like drawing up a business plan. How do we create easily accessible resources for people who want to write up a business plan for an idea they have and make that accessible to young people so that they can do it on their own is something we assume you should be able to do. You can download this from the internet. But often a number of the young people I spoke to, they'd say they had this idea and they just, every time they shared it with people, people would say, where's your business plan? And then what they had kind of scribbled down sort of get laughed at. So how do people who have skills in making business plans share those with others who don't?
Lihle, a similar question for you. As a young person, what would you say is the one thing that you that would really help you to build social connections and to help you to, you know, access economic opportunities?
The huge problem back at home is still basic education. I think we should put more effort on that and focus on it, because in order for you to get tertiary, to get bursaries, you need to have that level of education. Therefore, back at Free State, where I was schooling, they used to invite celebrities and in high school, people who have knowledge, who have seen things, to come and have a speech with the learners, of which it's a thing that you never find in a village.
Thanks so much, Lihle. I want to wrap the conversation up now. We spoke about the importance of bridging geographical gaps, the importance of having infrastructure, access to educational institutions. Adam spoke about how recreation and creating spaces for recreational activities can allow people to share mutual interests and ideas and experiences. And he spoke about the need for accessible resources. All of these combined can help to promote social connections and hopefully economic connectedness. I want to thank all of my guests. Thank you for joining me today and this conversation. It was lovely having you. And now over to you, those listening to this podcast. Using what you have heard today, you can try this reflective exercise to think about ways in which you can promote social connections. You'll need a pen and paper to write down these steps or download the takeaway sheet from our website, learninglunch.dgmt.co.za. Write down the following questions and spend some time reflecting on them by yourself, and then share your reflections with your colleagues. Start by asking yourself, who are the young people around me? What do I have to offer in terms of skills and experience? What is the value that I would like to add to a young person's life? Can I share my network or my skills? Am I really listening to what young people are saying? Deeply listening to the young person's dreams and aspirations. And how do I approach young people who are very different from me with empathy and sensitivity? You've been listening to DGMT's Learning Lunch. Until next time.